Welcome to 88 Names Podcast with your hosts, Blake Collier and Matt Ruff. On today's episode, we will be talking to Dungeon Dudes, who run the popular Dungeons & Dragons YouTube channel, where they give out advice, strategy, and role-playing ideas.
Drooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names Podcast. Drooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at drooted.com.
All right, so first off, for those who may not know who you are, do you mind telling us a little bit about yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Monty Martin.
And I'm Kelly McLaughlin.
And we are the Dungeon Dudes. We run a YouTube channel where we cover everything Dungeons & Dragons. So we talk about advice for new players that are getting into the game and share our thoughts and experience for players who are veterans of the hobby on how to go further with their D&D games. In addition, we also live stream our Dungeons & Dragons games on a periodic basis, usually every week. And so we have our live show called Dungeons of Drakenheim, which we are actually going to be publishing later in 2021, perhaps early 2022, depending on how long the printing takes, so that people can take that and play our game for themselves.
Awesome.
Yeah, and we're currently actually in season two of that campaign called Shadows of Drakenheim, which is kind of expanding on our world and lore. And yeah, we release videos 1 to 2 times a week. We kind of alternate every other Tuesday and release every Thursday. And yeah, we've been doing this now for a few years, and it's just Monty and I talking about this game that we love so, so much and digging into the nitty-gritty rules and everything that we adore about this game.
Both Kelly and I have experience in storytelling, theater, and film. And so we bring that background to a lot of the advice that we give on the show, because Dungeons & Dragons is very much at this unique intersection of a storytelling game. So it has both creative elements and more technical sort of gameplay elements to it as well. And I think that's a big part of the appeal of the hobby, is that you kind of get to marry this left brain, right brain, and have that experience with a group of friends together.
Awesome. Yeah. So your channel began in June of 2017, right?
Late June of 2017. Okay. I think the first videos went live in August.
Okay. Sweet. Well, now you have over 41 million views. I checked last night to make sure I got a fairly accurate number on that. So how much hustle does it take to become a popular brand on YouTube and Twitch in a short period of time like that?
You know, one thing that I tell a lot of people, I actually have had several friends and people who are looking to get started in YouTube and Twitch and all of that message me and ask me for advice. And my biggest piece of advice for that is that it requires consistency. And a lot of people who I think their channels don't succeed or they don't take off, there's two elements to this. Number one, consistency is like, you can't just be like, I'm going to release a video next week and then I'll wait a month and release one, and then I'll wait 2 months and release another, and then a week after that I'll release one. Something that we stated right when we were starting the channel is that we needed to pick a date and a time, and we would release every week at that day or time, and to the best of our ability we would always release every week. Now, mind you, of course, I actually don't know if we've ever missed a week yet, but I do want to put like an asterisk next to that, that it's possible, and like life does happen and things come up. But consistency is important, because not only does it keep you pushing to create more content, but as you grow your audience, they begin to rely on when to expect new material from you. They know that on Thursdays at 2 o'clock, they can expect something new from us.
Beyond consistency, there is absolutely an element of luck involved. I think for Kelly and I, we hit the zeitgeist of Dungeons and Dragons entering a new renaissance, and the space on YouTube talking to other content creators that are creating D&D type material on the internet. This is very much a booming sort of world and a booming sort of hobby element to that. But I think the other thing is that for Kelly and I, the the channel has been a learning experience and one of constant incremental improvement. We started the channel and we put our initial videos out there, which looking back on some of those first videos, I go, wow, these are like technically very poor. We were shooting things on an iPhone with a cheap little shotgun mic that we got for $100. And we were using, you know, these stand lights that we got on Amazon and doing whatever we could with the resources that we had at the time. And at the beginning, we viewed it as a hobby. Both Kelly and I had our own day jobs and the directions we thought our careers were going. We didn't really set out to make this our career. It became that over years. And it took a year of constantly posting videos every week, constantly creating content before we saw that momentum start to build. 6 months into creating content on YouTube, we were lucky to get a video that had a couple hundred views. And we went through this period of feeling like we were screaming into the void. Mm-hmm. And that can be a very difficult thing to get past, especially when you counterbalance that thought that for a lot of aspiring creators, there's this push to have your first two videos, your first three videos be perfect. They will not be perfect. Mm-hmm. They will be part of this spectrum of learning that occurs of posting every single video. And I look back on our very first episode of Dungeons of Drakenheim, which was the first time we live streamed our D&D game. The camera is blown out. The audio is not very good. We were trying to get a camera on the board so people could watch what was happening with our dice rolls. That didn't work. But we had a wonderful time. And if you look at the first episode of that show, and then you look at the 50th episode, we're actually using the exact same equipment in the exact same space. Okay. But the difference is so much wider because that is the difference of a year of experience.
That's awesome.
The last point that I'll make is that I think there is this X factor, which I guess could be attributed to luck, because I can't even tell you what the X factor is for Monty and I. But I do think that, like, somebody pointed out to me that actually the reason why Monty and I make such a good pairing is that Monty has this encyclopedic knowledge of Dungeons and Dragons. And I remember knowing that, like, well before we started Dungeon Dudes, I remember being like, there's got to be something here. I can ask any D&D related question to my friend over here, and he will be able to answer it without even looking at a book. And not only answer it, but he can tell me the fifth edition answer, the fourth edition answer, the third edition answer. So I was like, there's got to be something here. And then I came from this background of filmmaking. And like I said, I did a lot of speaking to generally medium to large groups. And I was like, okay, well, I know how to set up a camera and talk to an audience. So if I put Monty and I in a room together and turn on a camera and just start asking D&D questions, something cool is going to happen here. And it ended up working for us. But I do think it's important to know the dynamic you're trying to go for. And also, I see a lot of people who are trying to start channels and maybe they aren't sure exactly what they want to do. So one video has this vibe and this theme and this sort of through line to it. But then, like, a week later, they switch it up completely and then they try something different. And next thing you know, you have this kind of amalgamation of various things that maybe don't really have any sort of, again, consistency to them. And again, that means that your audience doesn't know what to expect from you. And I think it's important to know what the expectations of your audience are and play into that. And obviously, Monty and I, our videos have changed a lot since we first started. I remember the rules we wrote when we started the channel were they will be 5-minute videos. We'll take one rule from the book and explain it thoroughly in 5 minutes. Now we make 20 to 30 minute videos and we go kind of all over the map, but the format and the style has always stayed consistent. And that's been important for us.
There are the technical nitty gritties of understanding the guts of YouTube and the algorithm, which really to me sounds more like a terrible Dungeons and Dragons monster than anything else. And that those mechanical skills of understanding how to create an evocative title for your video, how to sometimes make the most of a clickbaity sounding thumbnail or make those sort of things, they do matter. And certainly over the course of creating videos, Kelly and I have very much learned the types of videos that are popular with our audience. So we can usually say, I love this topic. We're going to make this video because we love it, but no one's going to watch it. We did one of our favorite examples of this is Kelly and I love horror. And we did this really thoroughly researched video where we researched, we went in, looked at horror literature, talked about why certain kinds of horror work in Dungeons and Dragons and why certain kinds of horror are really hard to pull off in Dungeons and Dragons, and talked about how to get around some of those things. And we released it at Halloween and it really didn't even get the traction that we thought we would. And then the week afterwards, we did a video called The Five Most Broken Spells in Dungeons and Dragons. And that is our number one video.
Of course. And it took like 2 minutes of research as opposed to the horror one. Yeah. It took us like a month to write. So there's that.
You're preaching to the choir. That's a large part of what I write about is horror. So yeah, it's I would see that's very frustrating, but also makes a lot of sense.
It is frustrating how impossible it is to predict sometimes. Stuff you think is going to be a big deal is mm-hmm. not, and something you think is just a toss-off mm-hmm. just becomes the thing everyone loves. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How has the pandemic affected the production of this and the reception of it as well? I mean, I assume there are more people looking for entertainment online. I know I'm spending more time doing that, but obviously it's kind of ghoulish, but it's also mm. affected the way we all work.
Yeah, it's strange because Dungeons and Dragons is a social hobby first and foremost, and we thought it was going to have a very strong negative effect because people were not able to gather in person to play Dungeons and Dragons with their friends. But what we've seen is that many others have done exactly what we did, which was adapt to online formats to play D&D. It turns out that if you have good friends, it's actually playing D&D over Zoom works. It's different. It has a different sort of energy to when you play in person, but you can. And so as a result, I think that Dungeons and Dragons has allowed me to stay in touch with some of my friends in ways that others I haven't been able to, because we still play D&D together every week through Zoom. Like that was the thing that you got to go to church. And so for us, and we've noticed this across a lot of tabletop hobbies in general, that this, you would have expected video games and everything to have a great time over the pandemic, which I'm pretty sure they have, but tabletop hobbies have actually not, as far as I can see, it hasn't waned. Kelly and I have had to adjust the way that we make our videos based on the public health recommendations of our area. And so at certain times we've had to adapt to a remote setting for filming our episodes. Our live play is done remotely now. We had to get all that set up. But when the public health recommendations have allowed us to do so, Kelly and I have continued to work together in person.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest impacts that it has had negatively, like Monty kind of touched on a lot of the positive aspects, which is that surprisingly, people have been more drawn to our channel. And actually, a lot of people have started binging our live play, which I'm thrilled about, because for me, the live play is my absolute favorite thing that we've created. And I'm so thrilled that people are getting on board with that. But I will say that it was a bit of a blow to have to move the live play to a digital setting, because I think that one of the things that I loved most about our live play is the camaraderie that came from four of us hanging out in a room together playing D&D on a table. Because that is, for me, what really set us apart. Not only that, but we've been doing our second season now for over a year, and it was intended to be about a year long, but we've had to take two major breaks. One at the beginning of the pandemic to figure out how to move to online play, and another one because we're continuing that. One of our people who plays with us, Jill, she actually recently had a baby. So that's been a very exciting time, but it meant that we've taken another little bit of a break. And I really kind of just am very excited to get back to playing in the basement with my friends, but it seems like that's still going to be a little ways off. And I will honestly say that the videos that we record remotely, whenever I'm editing them, I usually grow a strong hatred towards having to film remotely, even though it's worked and we've been able to handle it. Every time that I get into the editing seat and I'm like, well, here's another video that we didn't get to film together. And to me, I'm very nitpicky when I'm editing, like the sound isn't as good as it was when we were filming in the room together. The video quality isn't as good. And I can just feel that. And I try to keep a pretty high standard for what we release. And so the pandemic forcing us to lower that standard a little bit just because of necessity has been something that we've both had to deal with a little bit. But overall, it's we've managed, and it's actually been pretty okay considering everything. But there were some learning curves and some adjustments that we had to make along the way.
So going back a little further, what was your introduction to role-playing games? And are you strictly D&D, or have you tried other RPGs as well?
So I'm to blame. So I got into tabletop games when I was a very young person, I think in my early teens, and even before that, was always been interested in fantasy and mythology, particularly Arthurian legend, and that got me into Warhammer, which got me into D&D, and I was the instigator that got a bunch of friends into the game. Kelly and I used to work at a computer shop together, and we kind of started bonding early about our shared geeky hobbies. And I just remember I have a very vivid memory of us being in the shop, being at the front of the store. It was a slow day, and being like, so Kelly, today we're going to talk about necromancy. and just sharing with Kelly that game. And then we got a group together from the shop and all started to plan together. And actually, so our live play campaign, Dungeons of Drakenheim, all the players in that campaign are actually players from that original campaign, from the original group that started in the from the computer shop. That's kind of the lasting legacy of that friendship. But I introduced Kelly to Dungeons and Dragons. I think Kelly, you've had a long history of games and whatnot yourself.
Yeah, for myself, it's kind of funny that I grew up in a small town, and small towns, high school, it's very cliquey. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, this sounds silly now that I'm an adult, I played Warhammer, I played Magic the Gathering endlessly, and I got made fun of for doing those things. And every time Dungeons and Dragons came up, I went, I don't want to cross that line. I'll just get picked on twice as much if I start playing D&D. So I shied away from it, but I still played all of these other nerdy games. And it was so silly that when I moved to the city and I started working at this computer shop, and moving to the city was actually a very freeing experience. I realized that there's all types of people here. You can kind of be whoever you want. And no longer were people picking on me for playing Magic the Gathering. I mentioned that I played it, and about 10 other people in the computer shop were like, oh, I play too. And that's when Monty was like, have you ever played D&D? And I was like, I think I want to. I think now's the time. And immediately it became my absolute favorite nerdy game that I ever played. It kind of checked all the boxes. Being a person who went to school for film, my real passion, if I boil it down to the core of what I wanted to get out of filmmaking, was I wanted to be a writer director, which really was a storyteller, and I wanted to create characters. That's what I wanted to do. I tried my hand at writing a novel that didn't really ever get finished. I wrote a bunch of screenplays that never went anywhere. But really, at the end of the day, I wanted to create characters and tell stories. And D&D gave me that. When we look at other games, I've started to branch out. You can actually see behind me here, I have the Alien RPG that I'm just reading through. I've done some Monster of the Week on our channel, which is a lot of fun. And Monty and I played a bit of Pathfinder, I think, as well. We dabbled in that. We've mentioned trying things like Blades in the Dark is one that's on our list that we really want to dig into. So I am starting to branch out a little bit more with my RPGs. And honestly, there's a lot of things to love in almost all of them. And what I've actually found is the more I play different RPGs, the more it improves my ability to be a DM or a player in Dungeons and Dragons.
I have looked at a lot of other RPG systems, from Gumshoe, Call of Cthulhu, to like the really kind of out there ones like Fiasco or, you know, Fate, and really, really indie stuff as well. I read a lot of role-playing game rule books. I don't get the chance to play a lot of different role-playing games as much. But even from those experiences of playing RPGs, I actually find that my appreciation for D&D improves. I really am interested in a lot of the mechanics of how role-playing games are designed and what those outcomes are. But ultimately for me, I love that the underlying message for me of Dungeons and Dragons has always been, here's a world where you can be a hero and you can change the world. And more and more as I get older, like, we don't get that feeling a lot in our day-to-day lives. And so getting that from D&D is really cool. There's a lot of RPGs that don't do that. I love them for it. But D&D is always a place that I keep coming back to time and time again.
This leads very conveniently, segues into my next question, which is, so we're recording this in late February 2021, and next month I'm going to be a guest on your live stream. And this is actually going to be my first time playing Dungeons & Dragons since I was in college, 35 years ago. And boy, do I feel old now. And, you know, I played a lot as a kid. And then after college, I just didn't have really a group. I when I played with other people, it was games like Magic the Gathering. But I have played since then a lot of MMOs. But watching clips from your YouTube channel just sort of reminded me what a different gameplay experience that is from live role play. Like, the main consequence when you remove the human dungeon master and replace them with the game server, the collaborative storytelling aspect of the game goes out the window. So like when I play World of Warcraft, the only part of the game that I can meaningfully change is my own character. And so it becomes this game of character optimization, essentially, where it's like, yeah, get loot, get experience points, level up, explore, you know, the different talent builds. And while you're doing this, you're exploring this fantasy world and having epic adventures, but I find the lore a lot less interesting, like the interesting aspect of those games, because I don't feel like I can meaningfully impact it in any way. I don't have a hand in creating it. So if I go on an epic adventure, I can't ever go off script and suggest something that the dungeon master hasn't already thought of. And it's an illusion. They're trying as best they can to create this illusion of, you're this epic hero in the world, but I don't really feel like I'm that. And so I take other things from the game. So I was wondering, you know, what your guys' thoughts on that. If Elon Musk, say, came to you and said, hey guys, you know, I've got this Martian colony I'm working on, and I need some top flight entertainment to keep the worker drones happy. Here's an unlimited budget to create an online role-playing game. What would you do with that? Is there a way you could take what you love about D&D, do you think, and translate it to an online game? Or
so if we're relating like computer and video games to D&D, I will say that like I'm a huge video game nerd. I love video games. I've played them my whole life. That's actually probably been my biggest form of engaging in this type of medium before diving into Dungeons and Dragons. But in playing Dungeons and Dragons, I think there's two elements that you unfortunately can never get around with, at least with today's technology. And those two elements are, first of all, even in an open world game, there are walls and boundaries that are placed in there. And I'm going to use, I just finished playing Resident Evil 7. And in Resident Evil 7, you're trying to escape a house and there's these crazy people after you in the house. And there's a part where I got out onto the balcony and I tried to press every button to just jump over the balcony and just run. But that wasn't an option that was presented to me. I had to stay in the house. And I was like, okay, this is ridiculous. If this was anything remotely real, I would hop over this balcony. I would take the 8-foot fall or 10-foot fall. I don't care. And I would just run into that forest over there and keep running. But unfortunately, I'm not given the option to do that. And all video games have this, even the more open world ones. Mm-hmm. you come to a house and you're like, I need to sneak into this house, but you have to find the open window or the unlockable door that they have presented to you. Whereas when I started DMing, I had the mentality of building things like a video game. And I actually very specifically remember building a puzzle house where the answer to the puzzle was on the top floor. And Monty was a player in that game who had played D&D a lot longer than me. And he gets to the house and he uses his familiar to look in all the windows, finds out that the clue that they need is in the top, goes back to town, builds a ladder and goes and breaks through the window. And as a DM, I was like, but I wanted you to solve the puzzle on the front door. But I realized in that moment that that just wasn't a part of D&D. You couldn't put these same structural walls in there. The second piece that a video game can never quite capture is we've come a long way with dialogue wheels. And yeah. I love the option of a dialogue wheel in a game. It's great. But still, you're pretty much boiled down to the fact that it's like, here is the nice answer, the middle answer, or the I'm a jerk answer. Those are your three options. And I specifically remember this moment playing Mass Effect, which was one of the greatest role-playing games for me, where the wheel of choices was always great. But they had this one option. I was being interviewed in the game, and there was like these renegade or like whatever the positive option was, where you pressed a button to instigate a positive or negative response. So the interviewer was starting to bug me, and a negative response button flashed on the screen. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to tell her that I'm sick of this. And I pressed the button, and my character punches her in the face. And then it like, everybody's like, why would you do that? And I was like, that's not what I meant to do. That's not what my vision of this character would have done. That was way too extreme for what I wanted to happen. And that was one of those moments where I'm like, man, they can't really capture the nuances of an actual interaction between two humans that can really branch in an infinite number of ways. So although I think that something like if we've played the Baldur's Gate 3 demo, if any of you guys have tried it, they're getting really close to something that feels very Dungeons and Dragons. But I think Monty and I even talked about that the limit of Baldur's Gate 3, which feels so D&D, is that when you get into the conversational part of it, it's still just a wheel with a handful of options, and you can never choose outside of that. So I think we need some technology that actually allows this sort of artificial intelligence to reach a point where you can have a microphone with your gaming system and actually speak, and the AI will respond. But I think we're still probably a ways away from being able to do that.
And one step closer to singularity, which I'm not sure is a good idea.
Yeah, so there's dangers there too.
With video game design, so much of that design is founded on building puzzles in various ways, shape, or forms. And there's a lot of ways to build open-ended puzzles, but ultimately, there's usually a set matrix of solutions. So even when we've seen games like Baldur's Gate 3 or Deus Ex or even the other Larian Divinity games, which really allow for a lot of solutions to the various problems that you encounter in those games, you ultimately do hit limits with those sort of things that a person acting as a dungeon master can unshackle you from and decide, yes, I am going to embrace your creativity in this moment. And one of the pieces of advice that I like to give dungeon masters on our show is that Dungeons and Dragons as a DM is the art of crafting a scenario and not a story. And so this is where my theater background shows. I like to draw this historical example of the Commedia dell'arte performers of the Renaissance, who often worked on very sort of a sketch improv comedy sort of model, a prototype model of that, where it was like, all right, so you got two lovers, their dad doesn't like the fact that they're in love. We got some good fart jokes in here that we're going to build in tonight and let's go. And so you just have this bullet point set of notes that you can run from, because everyone participating knows, oh yeah, I know how to play the ingenue. I know how to play the jilted lover. I know how to play the miserly father. And I know what this scenario is, but we're going to get into it and we're going to find out where it goes. I got some good jokes that I can pull out of my back pocket. And that's what D&D is doing. It's saying, okay, we're going to get some goblins in a cave. We're going to get a kidnapped blacksmith. We're going to get some fireballs and some wizards and a rogue, your archetypal characters, and we're just going to spin them together and see what happens. And one of the beautiful things about Dungeons & Dragons is that every single element of the game can be completely cliche and derivative from a narrative storytelling perspective. Like, if you wrote this in a novel, it would be your standard, you know, grocery store drivel.
But stepped on Tolkien, yeah.
Yeah, but because it's a role-playing game, you can't predict what the players are going to do. And we have this refrain that we always use on the show, which we say to dungeon masters, be prepared for your players to epically destroy your plan.
Yep.
And they always will. And it can be the most innocuous thing because you never know when the player's going to turn to something on their character sheet. In our game last night, I had a hapless villain who'd been transformed into a pig. And I thought, oh, they're not going to know who this is until one of the characters said, well, actually, I have a speak with animals spell. And I'm like, oh, well, there's half the mystery completely gone. And you have to learn to roll with those sorts of puzzles when things get upended as a dungeon master. And video games, the difficulty with video games is trying to predict all of the things that right. human beings can do. And of course, yeah, maybe there's going to be some sort of super AI that's built on, you know, a machine learning algorithm that runs a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons campaigns. And one day we will have this thing that can, you know, roll with the punches and create things in a sort of creative manner. That might be the starting point of, you know, we have machines that can use the machine learning algorithms and they can paint paintings and figure those things out. Maybe one day it will happen. But for now, that human creativity, that human interaction is part of the magic of Dungeons and Dragons. And sometimes a lot of the joy of D&D mm-hmm. is stumping the dungeon master.
Yeah. Well, it's like the classic rule of improv. It's yes and. Like, you know, it's...
Like, yeah, that's very, very much so.
I ran a session recently. Actually, it was my first time DMing on our channel for Dungeons & Dragons, at least. And the biggest compliment that I got on my DMing style was that whatever the players decided they wanted to do, I was always just like, all right, it's going to be crazy. Let's go with it. And I think that's the joy of D&D is, and it actually took me a long time to learn that. My biggest frustration when I was first getting into the game was I did the exact opposite. I created like, okay, they're going to go into the dragon's lair. I actually remember very specifically this plan that I had of my characters going into a dragon's lair. The dragon would scare them in the trophy room, then lure them into the lair. They would fight him. He would escape. Then when they were trying to leave, he would attack them on like the surface of the whole area. And I had this three-part battle. Well, it turns out that the paladin had a sentinel or something where if you hit the creature, their speed reduces to zero or something. So he scares them in the trophy room. And then he got hit and stuck on the ground and they killed my dragon in like three rounds. And then they just looted his entire lair and left. And I remember feeling so disappointed because this was like a big moment for my campaign. And ever since then, I've made sure that I'm just like, well, here are the bad guys. Here's what they're up to. And the players are going to come and epically ruin it. And now I prepare for that. And I just decide who's there and what they're doing. And then I have fun with the players. Mm-hmm. While they decide how to ruin it all, I'm their cheerleader, just being there like, yeah, let's blow this thing up. And that has become more fun for me.
I actually find for both players and dungeon masters, one of the awkward things that has kind of happened is that video games have trained our brains to work a certain way that actually isn't always conducive to D&D. Video games have taught us to draw inspiration from things like multi-phase boss fights that evolve and have like this puzzle box or, you know, certain, I played World of Warcraft myself as well extensively. And there were certain raids that I might as well have just been playing Dance Dance Revolution with how mechanically you had to like dance around the dragon's attacks and all those sorts of things. And it's easy to get inspired by those things because they're a lot of fun in a video game. Mm-hmm. But Dungeons and Dragons is also a game that actually doesn't rely, it doesn't matter how good your trigger fingers are. It doesn't matter how fast your hand-eye coordination is or your reflexes are. It's a game that is told through basically a tradition of oral storytelling. It's a verbal storytelling medium. And so I often tell folks that, you know, if you're looking to train yourself on a medium for D&D, it is actually best to listen to audiobooks and to read novels and to see how stories are constructed and to even look at the real world and look at the problems of the real world and describe a real world problem that humans are still trying to figure out and don't know how to solve. And look at that as inspiration for your campaign and your games, because a problem that doesn't have a clear solution is a great thing to use in Dungeons and Dragons. And so, in fact, many of our games and our campaigns have drawn on metaphors of real world issues like climate change. And, you know, just let's turn it into magical calamity, you know, overtaking the world. And all of a sudden now it's, you know, where are the elves going to live in the face of these magical whirlwinds going around the world? And yeah, it's an analog of a real world problem, but it gets turned into a fantastic element. And especially reading actual fantasy and actual science fiction, which so often extrapolates a real world problem into a fantastic dimension, is a great way to get those creative juices going and ask that question of, oh yeah, well, what if this problem, what if humanity encountered this problem? And then you play it out in a role-playing game and you actually ask that question. What if?
I mean, Lord of the Rings was just World War II through a different lens.
Exactly. So.
Mm-hmm.
From business needs to social events, an increasing amount of connection is happening online in immersive virtual spaces. Navigating these unfamiliar platforms and technologies can seem daunting. Locusium is here to help. Locusium understands, guides, and informs your project so you can spend time connecting with your community and teams. Unlock more possibilities for connection through virtual events with Locusium. Visit locusium.com to learn more.
So have you two experienced or heard about fully immersive VR, AR tabletop gaming yet? Or is the technology there yet for that level of interaction? And I know y'all have brought that up with your talking about video games and the inability for it to quite have the options that you need for tabletop RPGs. So have y'all heard about anything?
I don't have much to say on this, so I'll just say I've heard a little bit. I've seen a little bit. I think that what is being attempted is really, really cool. I just haven't felt like it's going to give me exactly what I want out of Dungeons and Dragons at this time. But I think it's cool that we're trying new technologies and we're pushing things in a direction that could be really cool in the relatively near future.
So I'll say the other side of my life is I am currently writing my PhD dissertation in drama, theater, and performance studies, looking at emerging technologies and particularly technologies of immersive performance and virtual reality, motion tracking, live streaming have all been elements of things that I've looked at. And so I have worked on several projects as part of my research that have actually involved experiments involving actors and performers using virtual reality to create immersive experiences on that front. And one of the things that I've actually told many of my colleagues is you just need to sit down with me and play some Dungeons and Dragons. because in fact, many of the my colleagues that I've worked with are trying to create what is fundamentally D&D with VR and haven't yet developed the literacy surrounding what makes role-playing games so special. So in fact, in a lot of ways, these immersive VR environments that do these things probably need to spend a little bit more time on the conceptual phase. I feel playing more D&D and understanding what it is that makes those interactions really special. I have a colleague of mine that's done some fantastic work where in developing a virtual reality gameplay experience that essentially was a dungeon master who could use a VR headset to fly into any NPC in Skyrim and take control of that NPC to have exactly what Kelly was saying about the dialogue wheel. And so actually having a real person, a real actor, or a real performer inhabiting those sort of things. And at least with the work that I've encountered with VR, that is ultimately one of the biggest things that you run into is that, well, now it's time to go hire some actors. The wonderful thing is that actually a lot of actors are super D&D nerds. Having worked in the Toronto theater community as a designer and working in all of these sort of things, like there's a lot of theater people that cross-pollinate with D&D. And a lot of them would really love to get lovely jobs working for VR companies while they can't go into theaters anymore. So I do wonder if there is some sort of confluence. It actually brings up these really touchy questions that the role-playing game world is trying to solve, because we've had increasing people talking about, well, what about paid dungeon masters? There's many people now that are making their living professionally running games of Dungeons and Dragons. And so I suspect that there is some sort of perhaps thing that combines the use of actors and performers with virtual reality elements to create those immersive things. It just seems like those might be, to me at least, may remain boutique experiences for the time being. They're certainly amazing ones, but they feel very boutique.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how do you see the worlds of tabletop RPGs and the advances of VR and AR technology interacting in the future? Do you think it'll largely be positive, or do you see some potential drawbacks to how that technology can impact tabletop gaming? And you've spoken to that a little bit there, but do you have any further comments?
I mean, we are very old school and we love our miniatures and terrain as well. Like we use tabletop miniatures, we use scenery, we use terrain. But I remain fascinated by all the ways that it can continue to bring people together. As far as I'm concerned, more people playing Dungeons and Dragons in whatever technological framework they are able to play is a great thing. There are people who are able to enjoy the enjoy D&D in a way that they never would have thought possible before, because the pandemic has prompted them to explore. Oh yeah, I can actually play this game over Zoom with my mom and my dad and my brother. And this is a great family activity that gives us some way of connecting with each other. I just personally feel that the human element is so central to this hobby, that is the real secret sauce. And when it comes to video games, which are a very solitary activity, there's great strengths behind that. As long as these things are always bringing us together, though, to play games and tell stories in that very, that still evoking that primal energy of being around the campfire together. Yeah, sure. Bring out the smartphones, bring out all of these things. I think that those things can always be enhancements. But it is always humans got to be at the center.
Yeah, I think if I can just add quickly to that, something that was very new for me is I was very much an analog D&D player. Like if I wasn't at the table with my friends, I didn't want to do it. And like even when we were originally like virtual tabletops have become very popular. And I can see that virtual reality and augmentation are things that are just another kind of step in this direction. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that when the pandemic started and we decided that we were going to move to virtual tabletop, I was actually blown away by how great it was. It's not my favorite way to play D&D, but it works. And there's a lot of people who can benefit from using it. So I think that as we push these sort of virtual reality and augmented reality options, really me saying that I don't know if it's going to scratch my D&D itch is not saying that it isn't the best avenue for some people who are coming into the game. And it might be the greatest experience. And I think that the more we push these different ways of engaging with the game, the more it's going to broaden the scope of what D&D can be.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a real simple example of that, one of the really convenient things about playing Dungeons and Dragons online through a virtual tabletop is that every token, you can track the hit points of that monster, the health of that monster. So you can just click on it and do it. Whereas with pen and paper, you have to be like, okay, so I'm going to take out a sticker and I'm going to put a blue sticker on this one, a red sticker on this one. And then on my pad of paper, I write red, blue. And I always lose track of that stuff when I'm running games of D&D and forget, oh yeah, the one on the left was the one with 50 hit points. The one on the right was the one with 55. I don't make that mistake when I run D&D online. So those augmented elements of the technologies can come into play. We use iPads to keep our character records, even when we played in person beforehand. So these opportunities are to bring in technology are quite interesting. Even the other ways, of course, is we are increasingly seeing Dungeons & Dragons hobbyists, even before the pandemic, were building tables that had television screens or projectors built into them, and then running the virtual tabletop map, and they would put the television set or the screen, the television set in the table flat, or the projector down on it, project the map, but then they would use real miniatures and real dice and have this augmented element already in their gameplay experience. So those things are really, really cool. And I think we're going to just continue to see more of those things. But again, people still gathered together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you recently did a video entitled Five Awful Mistakes We Made as New Dungeon Masters. And so as my final question, I wanted to kind of turn that on its head and ask if you can think of just, you know, maybe even one moment early in your dungeon mastering career when, you know, even if something was going wrong, your sort of brain lit up and said, man, this is why I love this. This is what's cool about this game.
You know, okay, I'm trying to think now. There was a moment, I think, okay, I got it. sorry, that took me a second. At first I was trying to think of me as a dungeon master, but I actually think my first big aha moment was, and Monty can attest to this, I was a player in his campaign and I was playing with a group of friends. We were all around the table. And I just remember this moment where I think my character might have been turned into a T-Rex by a polymorph spell, and our other character, who was a barbarian, we were fighting a dragon. And so I got polymorphed into a T-Rex. I smashed through this gate and we had this like almost like monster versus monster moment where the T-Rex and the dragon clashed. And then the barbarian player ran up my back, jumped onto the dragon. The dragon took flight and the barbarian was fighting him. He got in the dragon's mouth and was stabbing him. The dragon threw him to the ground, landed, breathed fire on him. The barbarian got up and cut the dragon's head off. And I remember that moment. And in my head, I can remember it like a movie. And to me, looking back and remembering that all that was happening was there was these little plastic figures on the table. And we were just like, this one moves here, this one moves here, now this guy goes here. But I don't remember that. I don't remember the minis at all. What I remember is this movie that plays in my head of what actually happened. And that was this moment where Dungeons and Dragons became this thing for me that was more than just a group of friends sitting around a table with playing with little toys. It became this really evocative storytelling experience where really, you were just sitting around the table heavily hallucinating with your friends. And that was wild to me. It was absolutely wild that I could have these moments that stuck out as these almost animated sort of epic battles and really intense dialogue scenes. I remember there were moments where Monty and I would be like standing at the table, almost like yelling at each other and pointing at each other. My sorcerer or wizard at the time had to like stand before this godlike being. And we had this discussion where we were going back and forth with witty remarks, trying to outdo each other. And even that was just Monty and I talking, but it doesn't feel like it. That's not how I remember it. I remember my character standing on this platform, floating in this otherworldly void, having this deep conversation with this godly entity that was just Monty. But again, that's not the memories I have. And that to me is the magic of D&D. The way that it plays in your head, the way that it impacts this sort of storytelling element that takes it so far away from what people outside of D&D think it's going to be. Because people outside look at it and say, okay, so you gather around the table with your friends, roll some dice and smash plastic together. And that's not what it is. It's so much more than that.
I think for me, one of the first times where I was like, wow, this is a magical game, was I was running a game for several friends, and I was the dungeon master, and I hadn't spoken for about 20 minutes. I was just listening to them speak, and they were speaking in character. They were having a conversation with each other, and it was not an easy conversation. Like they were disagreeing over something, but it wasn't players saying, oh, I think I should cast the fireball and you should run over here and cast the healing spell. They were talking about, no, if we let these people die, we are no better than our enemies. And the other player was like, no, this is what must be done. We have to do. And they were having a very real sounding conversation, and you could hear in their voices the almost a stress and anxiety that was happening. And of course, everyone's having fun. Like we laughed and cracked a beer afterwards. But for 30 minutes, that world and the problem in that world, this wicked problem that had no easy solution, was a very real thing for us. And so for many people, we think of Dungeons and Dragons so easily as a Monty Python sketch. And we think about the laughter and the humor that comes out of these moments and these epic cinematic moments. But more and more, what I've learned that I appreciate about Dungeons and Dragons is the drama. And that real question of how are you going to solve this difficult problem? And so I find myself more and more gravitating towards problems that are sweeping in scope, problems that don't have easy answers, problems that are messy, that people disagree about, that really rely on the flaws of the people involved in them. And the times when you wish people would act in a logical way, but they don't because they can't. And there's something Shakespearean about that as well. Mm-hmm. There's something very, 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 and so the first time I saw that happen at my table, when the players themselves were participating in this sort of magical moment, I was like, wow, this is a powerful game, because it isn't just about, you know, funny knights and elf ears. It comes right back around to that fantasy of, you have the mantle of what it means to be a hero. You have the mantle and the responsibility of what it means to be able to change the world. And sometimes that's not an easy thing, but it can be a rewarding one.
Yeah, I can see the book, actually. It's a Dungeons and Dragons as ethical role-playing.
And sometimes it's not ethical. Yeah, like,
exactly.
There were very many moments in our Dungeons of Drakenheim live play campaign, and we get comments in the videos all the time, where you get that moment of the players turning to each other like, are we the bad guys?
Yeah.
It's so funny, the amount of people that that come out and are just like, these characters are horrible. And meanwhile, like, looking back, I'm like, yeah, okay, I might have made some bad decisions, but it's weird that at the time I was trying to look, it's interesting to me to look through the lens of somebody that isn't me and analyze every situation, and I kind of get lost in it. And you know, like, one of my characters that I played in our Dungeons of Drakenheim campaign, he's a little bit selfish, he's a little bit loud and a little bit overconfident. And his catchphrase is, what's the worst that can happen, as he walks into a room where something horrible is going to happen. And a lot of people are like, why is he doing this? Why did he make this decision? Why did he, like, there's a lot of comments out there. And the more I think about it, the more I'm like, honestly, in the moment, through the lens of the character, it felt like the exact right thing to do. And I can't really give you a logical justification. It's just the way that the drama was playing out and the emotions at the table that were happening. And to me, that's something really incredible. And that's actually why I love playing D&D, is I like getting lost in my characters to the point where I kind of am also diving into this. I kind of wanted to be an actor growing up before I became a writer director. And so being able to do these weird character studies of these flawed individuals and the horrible decisions that they might make when facing ultimate evils is really interesting to me. And yeah, sometimes they're not always the best choices, but to me that makes good drama and good TV. So I'm here for it.
Awesome. Well, we've got one final question for you. And it's basically just a question of what's on the horizon for y'all. Do you plan on expanding to other platforms eventually, or just building your audience base, or besides the book, of course, the campaign book, like what else is going on?
You know, right now we are in the midst of writing the book, and it feels like an all-consuming thing. It is everything. We are doing more things on the channel and continuing our live streams and our work. And I think for Kelly and I, we kind of feel like there's a moment where we're going forward so fast that hopefully in a few months we'll get that moment to breathe in and look back and be like, wow, look at how far we came. So I'm looking forward to that, to figure out exactly where it's going next. But I think for myself, I found the process of working on the book extremely rewarding. And it's reinvigorated a sense of myself that this whole process for myself has been reinvigorating elements of myself as a writer, as a designer, as a creator that, have wanted to have these opportunities for a long time. So I feel very fortunate actually to have what I have right now.
It is interesting because I think before we got this kind of book deal underway, Monty and I were brainstorming 101 different ideas on how to push the channel forward. And then it was kind of a surprise when we got asked the question, hey, do you need help making a book? And we were like, why, yes, we do. Very much so. And it kind of just started to happen. And I will say, like, I was working on a bunch of stuff for Dungeon Dudes. I did a 4-part series of Monster of the Week that actually has gotten a bit of traction. There's a smaller audience, but a lot of people wanted to see me do more of that. And I was about halfway through constructing an entirely new a live stream for us to dive into. But unfortunately, I hope to revisit that at some point, and I hope to continue with me being a DM in some capacity on the channel and maybe starting a second live stream per week. But at the moment, the book has pushed everything to the back burner because I actually had a nice conversation with somebody about this the other day. That kind of went like, I was talking about how I felt oddly stressed some days about this book, even though I was getting a lot of work done. And actually, it was Joe that I was talking to, who plays on our show and is a member of the Drakenheim team. I was talking to him and he kind of said to me, like, the difference is he still works a day job. And when he's done at his day job, he punches out and within 5 minutes forgets everything that happened at his day job. And he's like, you don't get to do that. You go to sleep thinking about this book. You wake up thinking about this book. Every moment of every day, you might be sitting watching a show and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I have to go right now because I have an idea. Mm. And it kind of just started to take over, and not necessarily in a bad way, but I am learning that, like, the other day I sat down to write and I sat in front of my computer for an hour and a half and wrote like 3 words. And I felt really guilty about that. And then my partner was just like, maybe today isn't the day. You worked really hard yesterday. Take a break, forget about it, and come back tomorrow. And actually the next day I wrote like 5-10 pages and felt much better. So that is kind of the all-encompassing push forward right now. But we had talked about, we're always talking about new videos that we're going to make in the future, new topics that we're going to discuss. Like, we talk about broad topics that are like, we could do 30 videos about this. And then we start brainstorming what that's going to look like and how that might help our channel out. And at the same time, we've discussed maybe like playing different RPGs, playing different games, having like a board game night where we just live stream various weird board games that we play. All of these are concepts that we've tossed around a lot, but we need to wait until the right time. And when we have enough time and energy to make those things come to life at the degree that we want them to.
Kelly and I love video games. We play them all the time. We love playing board games. We love playing tabletop games. In fact, both during the pandemic, both Kelly and I got back into playing Warhammer Fantasy and painting up armies for Age of Sigmar and Warhammer 40,000 and painting miniatures again. And many of our fans have asked us, oh, hey, Monty, we would love to watch you play Baldur's Gate, or love to watch you play Civ, or love to watch you guys paint or create videos on all the other hobbies that we pursue. An interesting thing that I think happens for us as content creators is once you start being a content creator that takes your hobby into your career, it's very tempting to turn every one of your hobbies into a career. And there is a need for a work-life balance. So I would love to do videos on videos where we teach people how to paint miniatures. Miniatures are a huge part of Dungeons & Dragons. But, you know, for me right now, painting miniatures is a nice way to unwind at the end of the day. I don't think I would want to play live stream myself playing Civilization because I lose a lot and badly. and so there's a certain balance to that. I think for both Kelly and I, we talked about it for a long time. Oh yeah, we want to do board games and video games and all these other elements of hobby stuff. And so we're taking a measured pace because I think both Kelly and I are keenly aware that as much as we love Dungeons & Dragons and it is our passion and our hobby, it has also now become part of our career. Mm-hmm. And so there's a balancing act to establishing those things. So for now, I think we're just in that honeymoon phase of writing a book. So it's really quite wonderful to be able to, and I feel very privileged to be able to do that. So we'll see if we continue doing more of that, or if we do maybe look at some of these other hobbies that we have and say, what could we bring to the channel?
You know, I got asked the other day, and I thought this was pretty much a defining statement on separating the things I enjoy doing in my spare time from things that I'm going to broadcast on the internet. I was playing, I forget which game, I was playing one of my video games, and I got a bunch of questions. I posted about it on Twitter or something that I was playing this game, and I got a bunch of questions, and I was sitting there playing, and I checked my phone, and it was like, you should stream. Why don't you stream? We'd love to watch you stream. And meanwhile, I'm sitting there in like my underwear with a bag of potato chips and the controller in my hand, and I look pretty disgusting, and I'm just like laying there on my couch, and I'm like, no, now's not the time for me to stream. This is Kelly time. I'm just here to play video games in the dark in my house and not have anybody bother me or watch me or engage with me. And you do need that. And hobbies are a way of escaping a lot of the world around you. And I still love D&D, and it is still a hobby, but it's a hobby that I now broadcast and showcase. And I need those hobbies that I kind of do at home by myself and just enjoy in a leisurely kind of mental break sort of fashion where I'm resting and I'm not thinking too hard about it. And I can fail at the video game 400 times, swear and throw my controller, and nobody's going to be like, whoa, calm down. So, you know, I need that space to enjoy my own personal endeavors.
Yeah. When I know that Matt for sure doesn't understand the pressures of writing books. So
yeah, since I'm just sort of quietly, people can't see this, but yes, I'm just quietly nodding my head here as you're describing exactly like, oh yeah, I wrote three words today. What do I feel about that? And yeah. So, well, congratulations. And, you know, and thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Guest.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having us. This was such a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Yeah, this was really amazing. And yeah, we'd be happy to chat with you guys anytime.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast. For the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles.